Welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. This is the show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. Wonderful guests, Karen and Rick, who will introduce themselves. I've got Kim co-hosting with me here today, and two wonderful guests, Karen and Rick, who will introduce themselves in a minute. And on the line, we have the most special thing, and that is Gio, who used to co-host with the show way back about 6 months ago, is on the line making his reappearance and helping us out today with a very, very controversial topic. And, after our recent election, kind of fundamentally breaking Canada into right and left pillars, it's really made this topic about the intersection between LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans, and religion another hot topic that I myself personally would love to put to bed. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen in the near future. And we're going to talk about the HBT Working Group, and they've got an event coming up on May the 17th for the International Day Against Homophobia, where they're going to show The Bible Tells Me So, and it's going to be free, and it's going to be at the board office, and we'll talk more about that. But let's get introductions going here. Kim.
Hi, I'm Kim Gautreau. I'm a co-facilitator for the trans group in London. I'm also... Okay. That's it.
And Karen.
I'm a United Church minister, a lesbian out minister within the United Church.
Welcome to have you.
Thank you.
And Rick Telfer, longtime activist in the LGBT community, among other things, and a PhD student in sociology here at Western.
Welcome. And Gio, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Gang's all here. So let's just talk about this. And I want to start off by saying, there's several human rights in play when we have this conversation. We have the human right where people have the right to their sexual orientation. We have the human right where people have the human right to practice their faith and their religion. We have the right, according to the International Declaration of Human Rights, to assemble, and the right to protest. And I think all of these various rights come into play when we're talking about this topic. Rick, since you're our resident academic expert, how do those rights interplay, and how do you see those?
Yeah, there's a lot to be said, of course, about this topic. The reality is that rights will often come into conflict with one another, and the purpose of a democratic state is to find ways of balancing rights that compete with one another. But I think fundamentally we must remember that that no singular right should ever take away the rights of anybody else. And so the point of establishing what human rights are is not just to say these are your rights and they're fundamental and you can exercise them however you want, whenever you want, but also to find a way to balance them in a way that people are able to exercise their rights to the fullest extent possible, in a way that doesn't interfere with or take away the rights of others. Of course, the reality is that the debate ends up always centering around, well, what is interfering with one another's rights, or what does that mean to take away another's rights, and people have different interpretations of what that means and how to balance those things.
And Karen, you deal with this on a regular basis, and I'm assuming that there's a lot of challenges that you face with your identity and being a minister.
Absolutely, and I think you come right up against that conflict of rights, and all too often it's the one who speaks the loudest or protests, has the biggest signs, is the one that gets heard, and that's tromping sometimes on somebody else's right. I think we all have to use our rights responsibly and respectfully and with integrity.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that's always hit me with this debate, and we were talking about it a little bit earlier, and that I'm a human rights specialist. I'm a consultant. I talk about these issues. I speak. I consult on companies. I help them to mitigate these various different levels of conversation, and I will die for someone's right to practice their faith. I will die for them to practice their religion. I will die for their right to protest, even if it's against me. But on the other side of the coin, we have some religious, right-wing religious people that don't share that common belief with me. I mean, they won't die for my right to marry my female partner.
And the unfortunate thing is there are some people who are actually dying because mm-hmm. their rights are being denied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So one of the challenges facing people, and I'm going to play a little clip here. It's called, it's our This Is Me section. And this is a gentleman talking about his intersection with church and being gay.
Me.
This is what it's like
to be me.
To be me. This is what it's like to be me.
I converted to the Mormon Church when I was 15 years old. For the first couple of days after the baptism, you know, I had this feeling of like, yeah, God can do this. God can like cure me of homosexuality. Like I'm spending months and months and then years and years in the church, hoping that one day it's all going to be fixed and one day it's all going to work out. And if I just pray a little bit harder, or I, you know, serve a little bit more, or I do things a little bit better the next day, that, you know, that prayer is going to be the one where that God answers. And I'm going to wake up the next day and feel like a completely different man. You know, that day it never came. It destroys you. It destroys you from the inside out. I kind of internalized all the lessons that they teach you about, you know, if something's not working out, that it's a problem with you. Because God is perfect, and His authority and His Spirit, you know, just kind of extends through the church. So clearly, if there was a problem and things weren't working out, there was a problem with me. It felt like everything was falling apart around me, because my life wasn't syncing up. They're like, this is, you know, the only way you're going to get into heaven is if you're married and sealed in the temple to a woman. You know, it's like you're a member of the church, and the church hates homosexuality, and so you hate homosexuality. But you realize at the same time that you're gay, and so you hate yourself. The way I sort of came to internalize it wasn't that was a part of who I was, but that there was something dark inside of me, some temptation, and some just kind of like hand of Satan wrapped around my heart and wrapped inside my brain, and that, you know, if I would only embark into this like path of righteousness and like step into the light, so to speak, that it would, all the shadows and everything would just kind of melt away. That was sort of the illusion that I labored under for a very long time. They don't understand how hurtful and how damaging and poisonous it is to a person to hear from these people that, you know, that you love and that you trust, to suddenly get up there in front of a microphone and say things like that it's an abomination and that it's evil in the sight of God and that it's, you know, satanic. And to learn and to be taught that homosexuality is something to be afraid of or something to hate, all that really does is just, it gives license for these people to be afraid of people like me. I had my moment that I always wanted, where I wake up one day and everything is different, only it was completely the opposite. I woke up one day and I realized, no, I'm never going to change. And it's not that I'm never going to change because I'm always going to be wrong. I'm never going to change because there was nothing wrong with me to begin with. It was really just kind of a realization that I could love myself for who I am. You know, I'm gay. I'm 100 other things. But I'm gay, and, you know, that's all right. I unlock the door and I go inside, and my mom's watching TV on her bed, and I jump up beside her. And she's like, "Brayden, is everything okay?" And I look at her, and I'm just like, "Mom, I don't think I want to be Mormon anymore." And she hugs me, and she tells me, "Brayden, I am so proud of you right now. I'm happy now that you are being true to who you are." Just in my mind, there was no doubt that that was one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life. I'm happy with who I am now, and I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life. And it's because I am who I am, and I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of the journey that I've taken, and I'm happy that I don't have to fake who I am for anyone anymore. My name is Brayden Yamamoto. I'm proud of who I am. I'm happy. I'm gay, and I am an ex-Mormon.
And that, I think, is very common within faith communities when people find themselves at odds with their ministerials and how they're being internalized, their battle, and instead of externalizing it with their faith. And I think that really, really destroys people.
I think it does. I like he said, from the inside out, it's something that a burden that's placed on somebody that doesn't belong there. And we seem to have gotten away from celebrating the diversity of God's creation, and sexual orientation is part of that diversity, and it should be celebrated. At least it should be accepted. I hate the word tolerated, because it's like, oh well, if you have to be here, you have to. But we're not all the same. We are not all one. We are all different. We're all part of God's creation, but we're all different. Let's talk about it. Let's start the conversation. Let's get the conversations going and celebrate those that diversity and be able to bring that to the table.
G?
Yeah.
What do you have?
Well, I certainly have to agree with that. I actually recently started going to United Church here up here in the Ottawa area, and I absolutely love the fact that their motto is "God loves all, so do we." And they accept and embrace everybody from all walks of life, because they realize that as part of our faith, we are all the children of our Creator, and that He made us exactly the way we were supposed to be made, whether it was to face the challenges or to provide that diversity to other people. But we're all loved, regardless of what our scars are, regardless of what our stories are, regardless of how other people tend to judge us. And I absolutely love that, because I've just known so many various stories of people who were so conflicted between their identity of who they were and the internalization of the negative feelings provided by their faith and provided by their congregation, that they got to the point that they thought that death was the only answer. And that's really sad.
Exactly. And it's difficult. And Karen, maybe you can help us with what are some of the tools that people are in these situations can use to mitigate themselves personally. And you know, when they're in this situation, I mean, death is not an option. They're beautiful, beautiful people.
Absolutely. And you know, it's talking, it's gathering, it's finding like-minded people, it's finding those safe spaces, those authentic allies that are going to be with you through thick and thin. And I think that that's part of bringing everybody together, is for people to be visible about their solidarity with the gay community, people to be vocal about it, not just sit back and expect them to find you, but to say, look, you're welcome here. One of the signs that also often shows up at protests is John 3:16, "For God so loved the world, He gave His only begotten Son," and everybody gets all nervous. "For God so loved the world," underline world, there are no exceptions. And so we we've got to get that message out. We've got to get folks believing that and embracing that and proclaiming that so that everybody can find a place at the table. But don't expect the gay community to come and find you. Too many people have been so hurt by the church, by the people in the church. Even the United Church of Canada, who grabs headlines with their inclusivity, their social justice stand. It's not across the board. You cannot walk into every United Church in Canada and find a place of welcome. The ones who are welcoming, proclaim it as loud as you can. People have to find that safe space to be. They have to find that sanctuary.
That brings us to whenever I'm teaching companies and HR departments and counselors and anybody that's working with people, I always talk about the icons that they have on their desk and in the room and the inclusivity of those icons or the exclusionary of those icons. And it doesn't mean that if you're Catholic, you can't have the statue of the Virgin Mary sitting on your desk. But it does mean that if you are an inclusive person, you probably should have a rainbow wrapped around her.
Absolutely. There's so many subtle ways that we both include and exclude.
And one of the arguments, I live in Elmer, and I often joke that in Elmer, the church is more powerful than state. And we've seen it on numerous occasions, Children's Aid taking on the Church of God and various other things. And in that community, we have old colony churches, which are still segregated, male and female. They don't vote. They don't practice modern anything. But they're not Amish Mennonite, which is a total another sect. But I'm involved in all of these religious communities, and I've actually had people tell me that I'm a spawn of the devil. And when we're talking about all of these conversations about God made us and God did this and I'm a child of God, and how do we respond when people think we're not a child of God, that we're a child of Satan?
Yeah, I would say that you know, there are different ways of approaching these kinds of debates. There's always the approach of you know, finding allies and building resistance and engaging in dialogue. It all has to start, I think, with some core understandings about the nature of religious belief systems too. Being a sociologist, I can't help but understand religious belief systems in the context of society and through history. Of course, religious belief systems evolve and change through time, and they're different across spaces. So I guess what I'm saying is we can point out the contradictions between different faith communities. You think I'm a spawn of the devil, but this particular faith community doesn't feel that way, and yet you're reading similar or more or less the same Bibles. How do you account for that? Is this particular faith community over here that is accepting? Is that a spawn of the devil because it welcomes me? How do you deal with that? And I think in some sense, there's too often an expectation that LGBT communities are the ones who should be responsible for reconciling these conflicts and these contradictions. But in some sense, I often want to turn it around and say, well, this is really a problem with your interpretation of a particular belief system.
And usually it's just one random line that's thrown out from the Bible it's so obscure, it could mean anything.
That's right.
But you're using it to hate somebody when basically the entire Bible, any Bible, the Quran, Talmud, is preaching love and acceptance and doing all of these other things, and yet you're using one little random line and one little tiny misconception on it to hate an entire community.
Yeah, there's a fantastic quote. Actually, 2 weeks ago on our show, we replayed our Truth About God episode on Pastor Cusick, and one of his lines that I love is that he talks about people that are atheist or people that are, the name has escaped me at the moment, but non-believers.
Agnostic?
Agnostic, thank you. And not a good idea to lose your train of thought on a radio. But he says that he finds that the God that they don't believe in, he doesn't believe in either. And I found that to be an extremely fascinating statement, that the God that non-believers don't believe in is also not a God that he believes in as a minister of the Anglican Church and who has studied religion his entire life and been a minister all over. I really encourage people to go to betweenthemargins.ca and check out that episode, The Truth About God. It's a fantastic story about faith.
Another line that's always struck me is, I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. And, you know, with this spewing of hate, that's, you're showing your lack of respect for God and God's creation. And that's sad.
And sociologists understand religion, in some sense, some schools of thought within the sociological tradition understand religion as, and in particular concepts of God, as an embodiment of all that is good about humanity, or all that could be good about humanity. If you imagine everything that is good about being human and what is good about human civilization, God is the embodiment of all that is good of humanity. And so people often talk about their relationship to God. Fundamentally, when you think about it, one's relationship to God is supposed to be a blueprint for one's relationship with everybody else around them. And that's how I conceptualize it. I'm not a person of faith. I didn't grow up in a religious family. I was quite surprised by the time I hit elementary school to discover there was such a thing as religion. I had no concept of it. And so I have always... of course, as I've grown up, I've realized that many people are religious or have faith, and of course, I can't help but look at that from an outsider standpoint because I didn't have that. But I think there's another point to be made here, and that is that the things that people cite within Scripture, or the things that they give the most salience, right? The things that they give, that they highlight and pull out as being the most important, or the justification for their behavior. These justifications and this highlighting is always in large part a function of the social context around them, or of the community around them. To what extent are gender roles in society important to a particular community? If you find that gender roles are very important in a particular community or locale, you'll find that the faith communities in those communities and locales also incorporate those beliefs about gender roles into their faith. It will become more salient within their belief systems. When you go to, it's no surprise that when you go to a big city, we'll take Toronto for example. I've lived there for many years previously. You find much more acceptance and diversity in congregations, precisely because those more rigid ideological systems of gender and so forth are not. There's not as much consensus in a very diverse city like Toronto around some of these things, or at least they're far more contested, the boundaries of these kinds of things. And it's not just gender roles. It's all kinds of different ideologies that intersect with religion. So what becomes magnified, I think, in Scripture and in religious belief systems has a lot to do with what other ideologies are salient in particular communities and locales.
I think, unfortunately, the Bible and these proof texts that people use has become, excuse the expression, but a sacred cow that we don't seem to feel as if we can question or move beyond or use this as our basis, but we've grown in so many other ways in society. Why can we not get past this is the way that it was and this is the way that it ever shall be? We've grown in so much of our understanding of where these ideas came from in the first place. We have moved beyond that in our thinking. Let's get the idea of sexuality as well to receive the same kind of growth and appreciation as a lot of the other ideas that we've grown beyond.
Yeah, and Peter in the Truth About God show said, I mean, he views the Bible as a historic document, more like a newspaper that accurately depicted the events of the time.
Absolutely. It's a human construct. Some folks believe divinely inspired, but it's a human construct.
Yeah. And what he says is that in the Bible, just because it's in the Bible doesn't mean that it's God-stamped approved. And that if God really, really wants you to know something, then it's in the Bible in multiple different ways, in different places, that really drives it home repetitively and sends the message. And, I mean, there's a comedian joke out there, and I don't like to make jokes about this particular topic because it's really hot, but it does have valid in, I mean, it's a joke that says something like there's three abominations against gay people in the Bible and 365 against straight people. It's not that God doesn't like straight people, it's just they need more supervision. You know, and that speaks to Peter's construct that if God really, really, really hated gays, there would be a lot more about it in the Bible.
Well, aside from the Bible, if God really, really, really hated gay people that much, there would just be a crack of lightning and they'd all be dead. You know, it makes me embarrassed to tell people that I'm a Christian at times, because some people are so focused and so narrow-minded in their views of the world, and they take the Bible just absolutely verbatim, even though they are finding now that it has been, as a human construct, it has been edited over the years by people who try to influence the people under their rule. Constantine was a big editor. They have actually found the oldest version of pages from the Bible, and he had actually gone through and scratched things out and written things in. And I think, in my own personal opinion as a Christian, faith is very, very personal. And I'm sure a lot of religions and a lot of faiths believe that when you die, that's when you come across your final judgment, whatever form it be in. And you are accountable for what you've done at that point. Not what Joe Blow is doing down the street, not what the gentleman next door is doing or what the woman three doors down is doing, but for how your behavior is. So if God has the final word on everything, I have no idea what his will is. And I will not find out until that day I die. But until then, all I have is this earth. And unless I want it to be just a misery and a suffering until the day I die, I've got to be nice to the people around me. And I've got to embrace that community and enjoy other people and help them out, because this is all that I have. I will never have the answers to the questions. So at the moment, I just have to concern myself with what I'm doing and try to make life better for those around me, because it's hard to get people to respect you as a member of a religion if you aren't practicing what you preach, and that's love. And if you can't be an example of love, then you're just going to be brushed off and discarded, just like we tend to do to other people. So
wonderful. Well, we're going to continue this discussion after the break, and we'll be back at Between the Margins on CHRW.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters, we can do better.
And we're back with Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Kim Gotro.
We've got Gio Lakey on the line, and Karen Lowe, and Rick Telfer. And thank you so much for coming in here. We're talking about the intersection between the queer, LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans community, and religion, which is always a hot topic. And in the second segment, I want to talk more about the confrontation between the two communities. And I've always found it difficult as a human rights specialist and someone that promotes all human rights that other people who share those human rights don't share my view that everybody's rights are important. And I mean, this is where we talk about that right to assemble and that right to protest. But when is it appropriate? And as far as I'm concerned, when we're having a gay pride parade and the religious right are out with their signs and their banners and telling us that God hates, insert derogatory term of choice, and, you know, have our families on floats and we're going down the street and we're having fun and our children are viewing these signs, I don't always feel that's appropriate. What do you guys think?
I think I'm inclined to agree that the right to free expression and to protest is a paramount right. Of course, there really are no rights that come without limitations of some kind. My solution to those kinds of expressions of hate, misunderstanding, is to confront it and to engage in it either with dialogue or to, you know, there are a whole range of tactics that one can employ to confront and to deal with these things. I, for a few years now, in here in London, Ontario, people probably some of you may know have often showed up at London Pride parade with signs and friends that essentially mock protesters who have signs that say God hates, you know, as you said, insert derogatory term. Last year we had signs that said things like God hates shrimp, and we cited different parts of the Bible where, for example, I think shellfish is prohibited. So we come up with creative ways to ridicule and mock, and that's, I think, a valid form of protest or counter-protest, but there also does have to be a space. It's not always the time and the place at a pride parade where somebody's holding up a sign to engage in a full-on dialogue and debate about why I think your position is wrong and why I think my position is right, and maybe to figure out, you know, to be open-minded and critically minded about each person's claims. It's not always the best time or space. And let's be honest. I mean, when we're at a pride parade and there's somebody there standing there saying God hates you, you know, that's not the most it doesn't create the most welcoming space for that kind of dialogue.
Exactly.
I think, again, it speaks to living out our rights with responsibility and integrity. You know, it's to fly in the face of someone else's good time and family time is perhaps stepping over the line somewhat. And it's also not the time, I agree, to engage that because then it just nobody gets heard and it just turns into a free-for-all. But at the same time, there's ways to subtly and not so subtly show the other side. I'm very proud, Middlesex Presbytery of the United Church, just at their last meeting, voted to be a visible participant and supporter at Gay Pride in London this year. I think it's wonderful. We're going to be there with a banner that says that Middlesex Presbytery supports gay rights and is supportive of the community in London. And so that's I think a really visible way to be there and to show your support, and I hope a great crowd will come out.
And as far as I'm concerned, that's the way to have these conversations is to engage in an intellectual dialogue and to have these conversations. And the HBT Working Group has actually created this space and for that exact purpose. On Tuesday the 17th, at the London School Board's head office on Dundas Street, everybody can come out, and we're showing the movie The Bible tells me so. And then afterwards, there's going to be a panel of experts. Rick is moderating that panel, and Karen, you're on that panel along with a whole bunch of other faith-based leaders in the community, where these people that want to engage in this conversation are welcome. It is a free event. Come out and engage us and have that conversation.
And HBT, I'm not sure if you mentioned, it's the Homophobia, Biphobia, Transphobia Working Group in London. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. I think we have to accept to some extent that there will be people whose minds we just can't change. And there are people who, you know, I don't expect, you know, out of, say, 10 protesters with signs at a parade saying, God hates you. we'd be lucky to win one of those people over with our intellect and in our arguments, truly, right? And so we have to realize that there are going to be some people who just can't be persuaded over to our perspective and into a position of acceptance. And so for me, that calls into question our tactics and our strategies about how do we address homophobia, biphobia, transphobia in society at large and in faith communities. And if you take the view, as I do, and as I mentioned earlier, that faith communities are never separate from their wider social context, what that means to me is that we have to address all kinds of other belief systems and ideologies that exist in society in order to shape the acceptance levels within faith communities. So that is to say, in some communities, as I said earlier, gender roles are far, far more salient. They're far more important to people than they are in other locales. So in those communities where gender roles are very important, that's going to be very salient, you'll find, I think, in general, in the faith communities within those areas. So we need to start to tackle things like sexism, right? The control of women's sexuality, the nature of gender and how it is socially constructed and so on. If we don't tackle those things independently of trying to engage directly with faith communities, we're not going to have much luck. You have to deal with all of these things in different fronts. Yeah. So there will always be people whose minds we can't change, but I guess what I'm saying is we can affect the context in which those people operate. And if we can't change their minds, maybe if we keep working away at the context around them, we can change the minds of the people who come after them, or the children who come after them in those communities.
That segues into an interesting clip. And just to give you the background on this clip, we had an event in London here where organizers organized an event called Slut Walk. And it was an action against a Toronto police officer that said that women need to stop dressing like sluts to protect themselves. And, I mean, there's a whole two shows and two episodes on the topic on Between the Margins website. So I won't get into the full details about that. Look it up. Watch the show. Listen to the show. But we had two individuals from the religious right that engaged some of the people into a conversation. And I was one of those individuals, and they allowed me to tape the exchange. And I've got a piece of that conversation for you now.
But I love you, and I say repent or perish. Yeah. And when you perish, it will be penalty. If I pass a red light, I pay $300, whatever it is. I have to pay penalty.
The law without penalty is no law.
And God has a law. And when we pass his law, we pay penalty in the fire.
And when a man rapes a woman, the woman is blamed.
And he's going to pay for it, and she will pay because she prays. Both will be judged.
How is a woman judged for getting raped?
The way you present yourself.
Say I'm in sweatpants and a sweater.
Okay, let me explain that from the Bible. I know you don't believe the Bible, but just because this is my personal view. Jesus Christ said, he came to the Jews, and the Jews had the Old Testament. And they weren't doing a very good job of living up to the Old Testament laws. In fact, they had made a man-made religion out of that and made a whole bunch of traditions. And Jesus came to smash that. But he said, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the Pharisees, you will not see the kingdom. And he said, I didn't come to do away with that law, but I came to magnify it. I came to expand it. So he says, in the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments, which our laws, our culture, our art, our education system is all based on that. Those Ten Commandments, one of them says, if you commit adultery, you've broken one of the Ten Commandments. must repent. Jesus said, if you lust after a woman, to look after her with lust, you've committed adultery. So that man will have to answer for committing adultery.
Just look at
according
you
to the New Testament. Now, this is not to squash man under his thumb. Jesus Christ said those things for our protection. Well, she's obviously obviously wanting man to do that. Otherwise, she wouldn't present
it. She's not dressed for her husband or for her mother or father.
She wants
that. She's dressed
for
somebody.
She's asking people to look at her.
I'm dressed for me. I'm dressed for me.
No, you're not.
You just lusted her.
You
just lusted
her. How am I lying to myself? This is comfortable. It's warm out. I'm comfortable in my temperature.
When it's freezing out.
It's not freezing out.
I'm sweating. Okay, so anyway, let me finish my point, because you had your point,
okay,
right?
Okay, go ahead.
All right, so Jesus said that, right? Now, the man is going to have to answer for committing adultery in his heart if he's lusted after a woman. It takes two to commit that act. Every time a woman causes a man to lust after her as a result of the way she's dressed, she commits adultery every time.
Saying, well, not putting him aside, but say you're following these rules and these norms of society or whatever, how I should dress, blah, blah, blah. Is that not in some way restricting my personal freedom to be happy and to just be myself?
No, because all of us have a responsibility in this society to present ourselves in a way that is conducive to producing a better society. The more educated you become, the less moral you become. You have a responsibility. I have a responsibility. One way is to present yourself in a respectful manner. I mean, if as a school teacher, kids in school see women, girls taking off all their clothes, do you not think it's a distraction for those poor guys?
But why is it a distraction for those poor guys?
Because women use that as a power.
And why is it a power?
Why is it a power? Because they know that men are attracted to that. And that if you dare touch them, then that man is going to be sent to jail.
As he should be.
But do you not feel the woman has a responsibility?
No.
No.
Why does a woman have a responsibility? How is my responsibility as a woman to keep your behavior in check?
Because when you present yourself in a way that sends a message,
so you're saying men are
I'm
weak
available,
women.
Come and get me.
Do you?
And then
when you have to go to the bathroom,
it, you get upset.
When you have to go to the bathroom, and you really have to go, did you just urinate on the closest tree?
No.
Or do you go and find a restroom to go?
Right.
Okay. So you have the urge to go to the bathroom, but you can control that urge long enough to get to the washroom. But you as a man, because these are here, you can't control yourself all of a sudden?
Why do we have a law, or at least we did until a little while ago, that a woman couldn't take off all of her clothes in public? Why?
Because the laws are rooted in Christianity.
Remember, my dear sister.
I know.
That's why.
And that's why when you take that, you remove
that doesn't make you know what you want.
Rick? In some sense, I think it's a, you know, these kinds of exchanges, I've had these before, they go in circles, and it's almost a caricature of everything that's wrong with certain elements within faith communities. And I think, to be fair, I don't think that kind of thinking is representative, you know, even in some fairly conservative areas. But it's I think what it shows first and foremost is just how people interpret things and take positions on things from a very ideological standpoint. They have particular beliefs and they use religion to highlight them. They say it's sort of like when you you already have your mind made up about an issue, and then you do quote unquote research on the issue, and you go through your list of references to find everything that supports your position, but you don't accept or consider anything that might not.
I'm glad Rick spoke first so I could kind of get my blood pressure under control. And I think it's safe to say that those are a couple of minds we're not going to change. But the thing is, it is as many proof texts as they can come up with, I can come up with some of my own to counter those. And the only proof text that I need is Jesus saying, distilling it all down to the great command, love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. And if you're doing that, I don't think that you can go too far wrong in this world, that you're not going to have much to answer to, other than if you're not being your authentic self. I think that that's what we were created to be. And these folks believe they're being their authentic selves, and God bless them. More power to them, I suppose. And they have a right to their beliefs and a right to be able to express them. But it does become just a circuitous argument. It goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. Information is power. And as much information as we can provide out there, the more powerful a community we become.
Oh, no. Information is less moral. You heard it here, folks.
That seems to be the case.
I actually don't usually give airtime to this kind of stuff, but I think it's really important for people to understand the conversations that people like us have on a regular basis. And these conversations, I always say faith is a very, very, very personal thing. It gives us the strength to get up in the morning. It gives us the strength to lay our head on the pillow at night. It is very, very important to us. And regardless of what faith you have, it gives you strength and it gives you security. And it is a wonderful, amazing thing. But when you put people into a community, which is a church community or any other community, you can never find two people sitting beside each other that share the exact same faith. They all have their own interpretations. They have their own way of believing, and they have their own way of expressing their diversity. And I think that is also a beautiful thing. And these people that come out to these events, and I mean, it was a women's rights rally for women. But they felt that they needed to come and save women from how they dress. I have a hard time finding the connection between those.
Go ahead.
I think those two particular individuals are using faith to sort of mask their underlying sexist behaviors. Like, that was an incredibly sexist dialogue, and there was nothing constructive about it. And they're, again, like Rick had said earlier, using their own societal views to put down other people and using these little minutiae of scripture to say, oh, well, this is why we are justified in saving you, quote unquote. And it's just wrong. It's completely sexist, and it's not religious. That is not faith. That is a sexist behavior.
And I find a lot of these dialogues are starting to lack civility. We're not at a point where we can say, okay, we disagree, so we agree to disagree. It's got to be really in your face and provocative and inflammatory, whereas live and let live sometimes. I mean, the gentleman who sits across from me at work is voted conservative. I voted differently. I don't sit at the edge of his desk with a big sign that says God hates conservatives. No, he's absolutely entitled to his opinion. And I said to him, then we agree to disagree. I won't sit here and rail on you about all the reasons that you're wrong. If that's what you believe, fair enough. I absolutely support your right to believe in it. But I won't push my views down your throat, and you don't push them down mine. We will just coexist. We'll treat each other civilly, even if this one point we don't have any common ground.
I think we recognize that society is a jungle of contestation over morality, and different people have different views of what is moral. And fundamentally, what one considers moral is never separate from social control. And there are all kinds of forces that exist within a society that seek to control people and populations for all kinds of particular ends. And religion is just one belief system that is often used as a front for a particular agenda of some form of social control. And so I think we have to look at the forces behind these agendas and understand that that religion is one part of that. So we have to change the people's minds within those communities as much as we have to change the minds of the people outside of them.
And one of those tools is the documentary A Bible Tells Me So. And I warn you that there is some more of that hate messaging in this clip, but we're going to play it now.
Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones who
homosexuals are allowed their civil rights, and so would prostitutes or thieves or anyone else.
God hates fags! God hates the Episcopal Church!
Like Goebbels said, working for Hitler, you tell a lie enough times, the whole world will believe it.
Marriage cannot be severed from its cultural, religious, and natural roots.
There's nothing wrong with a fifth grade understanding of God, as long as you're in the fifth grade.
I can't do this to my dad. I knew that being gay, being a lesbian, does not fit into the perfect political family.
Unconditional love, which is what I believe we have for our children, means exactly that.
God says in the Old and the New Testament that it's an abomination.
They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them.
I'm going to read the passage very differently than someone who might be white, male, and straight.
Moses teaches in Leviticus that it is an abomination to eat shrimp.
The one worry I had was that Chrissy was going to face horrible discrimination now.
Fear does terrible things to a society.
The New Hampshire Diocese of the Episcopal Church made some history this past weekend.
Death threats had already started.
Gene had a bulletproof vest under his vestments, and I realized how scary it must have been for him.
Gene Robinson is a holy man.
For a long time, the Bible has been misused to support prejudice, apartheid, segregation, slavery, the second-class citizenship of women. Now it's being misused to condemn gay people. It's an old trick. Fundamentalist Christians have been using it throughout the ages, and now they're doing it again.
You know, it's all about civility, and it's about bringing those seemingly polar opposites together to dialogue, to support, to respect. That's what it's all about. It's not about hate. It's not about proclaiming someone else's hate. It's about bringing those sides together to look. We don't want to become a homogenous whole. We want the diversity there. We want everyone to be their authentic selves and to stand up for the rights of others.
Exactly. I mean, we have a saying when I'm doing diversity training and everything else that everybody has a happily ever after. It's never the same as the person sitting beside you. And if you're standing in the way of their happily ever after, you're probably violating the Human Rights Code.
For me, I always look at this particular issue again from the standpoint of how do religious convictions and values interplay with the values and convictions around people in those particular faith communities. So as an activist, I can't help myself, but I'm not rooted in any particular faith community, so I don't engage in those particular conversations, but I do engage with all kinds of issues around them and support all kinds of issues that break down bigotry in all its forms. Because if there's bigotry in the external, so-called external environment, there's going to be bigotry on the inside too. And so we have to be addressing all forms of bigotry, both within and outside of these types of communities.
Last thoughts, Karen?
Just keep talking. Keep proclaiming your solidarity so that folks know they have a safe space to be, where they can find a place of belonging and a place to be heard. Everyone has a right to be heard, and everyone has that that place at the table. So proclaim your solidarity. Please be visible, be out there. People's lives are depending on it.
And please come out and continue this conversation with the HPT Working Group on Tuesday, May the 17th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Thames Valley District School Board Head Office at 1250 Dundas Street. The event is free. We're showing the film that is The Bible Tells Me So. And then following that, there'll be a discussion panel whereby we'll have a discussion between everybody that's there, and there will be counselors on scene just in case somebody gets triggered, because this is a very personal topic and a very personal event. This has been Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. Special thanks to Gio for coming back on air. Rick and Karen, thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
I'm Tim Gautreau.
I'm Michelle Boyce. You have yourself your happily ever after, no matter what that looks like to you, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks.